It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And oh wow, the gang is back together. Welcome to FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. I'm Sean Sullivan, that man right there, back from assignment, Mike Ward.
Yeah, I stay on too many assignments, don't I?
Yeah, we're all getting assigned. So many assignments.
And you getting ready to go on assignment.
Yeah, and I'm going on assignment myself. It is that time of year. Oh my gosh, bow season already in, you know, you have, and by the way, I mean, I don't think we have to still do this, but let's still do this. Y'all remember first 10 days, bucks only.
A lot of people forget that every year.
Yeah, and that is, so you understand why, the same logic and science that said, hey, we need to move the ending date to February 10th because of where the peak rut is in a lot of places, is the same way to say, okay, if the peak rut is then, those fawns aren't ready to be separated from mama at this point. And, you know, we've talked about it too, in your hunting club or wherever, make that choice. You know, I mean, do what you want once it's legal, but we wait.
Right.
And, you know, you'll say, doe came out, didn't have a fawn with it. Just wait. That fawn may not be the first one out.
That's right. Yeah. So, if you don't pull the trigger instantly.
Yeah.
So wait and see. Give it a couple minutes.
Or pull the trigger on your release or release your.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. So that's why. So for the first 10 days, it's just bucks only. And hopefully you kill some good bucks. Send some pictures into our Facebook page, facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. All right. Lot to do on today's show. Let's get caught up. You have been out in the Midwest.
Yeah.
In the land of giants.
Yeah.
I want to say this, too. In the land of giant whitetails that obviously Kansas is known for, but Mike sends me some pictures the other day, and he knows that I also am really into Western game and elk, and he sends me an elk on picture on one of his game cameras that would be, I don't know how to score them that well, but I'm talking about a trophy bull elk.
He would be a trophy for sure because he was a non-typical. I forget.
Just awesome. Awesome antlers.
I had to pull it back up. I want like 12 or 13 points or something on one side.
Yeah.
And, 7 or 8 on the other side. Had a big paddle with six points on it. I mean, it was a
But you're
really
getting this
neat
picture. So, Mike, this is one of his cameras he's running on his lease in Kansas where you pictures of whitetail, big buck, big. And then here comes an elk. And people don't know elk are present in Kansas. They're, you know, rebuilding, there's limited tags and stuff for it. But just to see, so I knew there were elk in Kansas, but just to see that elk.
Yeah.
And y'all aren't exactly in northwest Kansas.
No, that is the strange thing. Now,
isn't that right? As it goes north and west, you get a few more elk.
There's a huntable population to the north and west.
There's a big military base or something up there in the northwest that has a pretty good. But you're not in the Northwest.
No, our buddy Mike Eubanks, he kills one just about every year in Kansas. He killed one this year, killed one last year. So, and he's hunting in the Northwest sort of Kansas. But now,
You're not in the Northwest.
No, I'm not. I'm in the central, I guess kind of the mid east.
Okay,
a little east of middle of Kansas. Anyway, I showed the picture of that elk to all the farmers that I hunt with and all the people that work with them and all, they've never seen an elk. As many years they've been up there, they've never seen an elk.
You know, I wonder
up there, in that area.
In that area. So I wonder if he's not looking for girls. You know what I'm saying?
Like coming through.
Yeah.
Well, I got pictures of him one night for about 10 minutes.
It's wild just to see how like a normal, I mean, I know it happens. You see it from out west all the time, but can you imagine? You got your game camera. It pings your phone. Okay, there's a deer. There's doe. There's a little buck. And there's some turkey. There's an elk.
Yeah, and that's exactly our reaction.
It was cool.
It was exactly that. And we was all texting and calling each other the next morning. One of the boys texted me like at 5 o'clock in the morning. I said, "What in the world is that boy?" 5 o'clock in the morning, what is he texting me about? I said, must be important. Anyway, it was an elk picture.
Well worth it. All right, so let's talk about the whitetails. How's it been out there?
Well, it's slow. My grandson, Dylan, hunted for 4 days. He got a tag. I didn't get a tag. And it was real slow. It was pretty warm. It was in the...
They cut the corn yet?
They're cutting it now.
Okay.
Cutting corn and cutting some soybeans, too. Okay. So that's really scattering the deer out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when they start cutting that corn, there's a lot of corn in those fields, so they just get spread out big time, and they just don't come to your feed
right.
very well, you know? So it's going to get better in about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, most of the corn will be cut, if not all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the soybeans, probably half or three-quarters of that will be cut. I mean, they're trying to get it in before the rains come.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, then they start to concentrate them a little more.
Yeah, because you take, you know, all that cover where they could lay out in the cornfield.
That's right.
And now it's gone.
Yeah. You know, you wouldn't think they'd lay out when it's 80-something degrees, they'd be laying out in the corn, but they do. Dillon was coming out of the woods right next to a cornfield, and two big bucks come walking out of the cornfield, you know, so about 20 yards from
mm-hmm.
it. So, yeah, that's what they do. I mean, they were laying in that corn.
Now, you know, in my experience over time, hunting Pennsylvania, where I go, South Central Pennsylvania, is nothing like the size of Kansas fields. It's a lot smaller. But, like, on our farm up there, there's about a given year, depends on alfalfa and corn rotation, but let's say it's 70 acres of corn.
Yeah.
Okay, and there are a bunch of deer, before it's cut, they don't even go what we call back up the mountain each day. They just stay down there. You know, you can find them. Depends on when they cut corn. They cut stuff so much earlier now than they used to. But it would be during bow season up there. You'd see deer. They come out and come in like a turn row between two fields of corn. You get a shot at them, but they go right back. You know, where as soon as they cut it, they do something like out of a Field and Stream magazine. They go up to the top of the mountain and then come down at night up and down, you know.
Yeah. It changes the habits.
It changes the habits big
time. Yeah, they sure do. So that's what they're doing right now in Kansas. And we're getting some pictures of, you know, several really nice bucks. But the bucks that we were getting pictures of a lot, they just kind of disappeared. You know, they just kind of gone. I don't know what the deal is.
Did other different bucks show back up when they left?
No, not really.
Because
no,
I didn't know if it'd be that shuffle.
Maybe one or two, but not like you would think. Something else is taking their place or something. Tons of does showing up.
Okay.
Little bucks, but the big bucks have just about disappeared. Not even nocturnal. Normally, we get pictures of them, you know, at night, 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever.
Even in Kansas, they do that 2 o'clock in the morning.
Same thing. It's no different than here. It really isn't. I mean, I guess they start getting a little pressure on them. Or
mm-hmm.
What really changes the deer habit out there is the food, just like we were just talking about. I mean, there is so much food out there. It's just soybean fields, corn fields, barley fields. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as far as I can see, cow pastures, mm-hmm. you know. They're either in cattle or agriculture, one mm-hmm. or the other. Everybody is up there. That's how everybody makes their living up there. So when they cut these fields, things change.
Yeah.
And the temperature and the weather.
What's it been like out there?
It's been in the 80s.
Okay, it's been hot.
And then in the 60s, low 60s, maybe high 50s. So not much different than here, really.
Okay.
About the same.
So you had a lot of stuff working against you.
Yeah, we knew when we went out there, and Dillon knew when we went out there, that his chances of killing what he wants to shoot was going to be slim.
But the nice thing is you can argue that if you can go multiple times, right? I mean, obviously, if you can only go once, you want to be there in that rut period.
Right. That's right.
But beginning of the season, they're on a certain food pattern. That's not a bad way to kill a big deer either, because it's reliable.
Yes.
More than like the rut, it's rolling dice versus...
You never know during the rut.
Which can be great.
But they are moving, mm-hmm. and they're moving all day long.
Mm-hmm.
So your chances of killing a big one is good during the rut.
But this food, you know, this early stuff, it's not the same, but you might be able to pattern one better. Say he's showing up in this area same time of day.
The boy that killed that big one opening day of mm-hmm. muzzleloader season on our lease, it's 181.5.
That's a stud.
That's a monster.
Mm-hmm.
But he was coming out every night, night. And then that, you know, the day he went, it came out in the daylight and it killed him. But we knew he was coming.
Right, that's
every
easier to pattern.
Every night he was there. We had him patterned like another one we had patterned. I told you about on the last show we did. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was coming every day. And something, I guess they were losing their velvet about that time, too, about a week before we got there, about a week before the season opened. They were losing their velvet. And the one that Joe Chastain was hunting, he lost his velvet like 2 or 3 days before we got there, and he quit coming in daylight. Mm-hmm. Now, what changed there? I don't know.
And if y'all want to go back in our podcast archives too, conversation we had back last month, I had Bronson Strickland, so deer biologist, MSU Deer Lab guy on, and he and I were talking about that kind of. He was showing their radio telemetry tracking, yes, and how, you know, he said, like, no matter what time of year, it's a little bit less in the month of July, but the rest of the time, all bucks will take a little walk around. Okay, yeah. They're going to take a loop for a day or two or whatever. He said, also, there's some 25% or something. I don't want to get the, let's say 20%, make sure I don't overstate it, of bucks that will just, let's see, 15, that will up and find a whole new, like they, like you see them all summer. And I deal with this too. I mean, yeah. You see them. And then they're just gone. It's not like they come less. They're just gone.
Right.
And he says there's a certain number. Their radio telemetry shows them there's a certain number of these bucks. It's not the majority, but they have two home ranges. They got the summertime home. They're fancy. They got a summer house.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once things start changing, testosterone comes up. I guess that's the motivator. They leave and then could go miles. And they live there for months and months and months. And then if they don't get killed, they show back up same time of year at your place.
Yeah.
So they've got radio telemetry on a buck that, tell you what, we'll talk about this when we get back for the break. But there's one that they had between Mississippi and Louisiana. You know what's between Mississippi and Louisiana?
There's a big old river.
And this buck, same time every year, walk down the banks of the Mississippi River, swim the Mississippi River, go spend 3 months or so in Louisiana, ag on both sides. Yeah. And then certain time of year, swim back across and do the Mississippi thing. Coming right back. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have y'all along. And yeah, bow season going on here in Alabama. Talk some more deer hunting here. We mentioned this going into the break, and you can go back. If you'll look for the show, it would have been the third weekend in September when we were at the G&D Outdoor Expo.
Right.
And Bronson Strickland from MSU Deer Lab was a guest in
Mississippi State University.
Yeah, he's like just a brilliant guy. And, you know, he's a kind of guys I like Chuck Sykes and all these. He's a hunter. He loves to hunt. And he figured out how to get in the science of it. And so he, even though they sourced it, being a state agency, they sourced their hunters to what they wanted to know. But he and his fellow scientists are all deer hunters. So they ask the same kind of questions that we would. If you were given all the money and telemetry equipment and all that, what would you try to figure out? We'd try to figure out what bucks are doing, right?
That's right.
And that's what they did. But yeah, so the study's wide ranging, but we're talking about that group, let's say it's 15%, that just up and go find a new home range.
This is about 75 deer that they tagged.
Yeah, 75 to 80, somewhere, 75 to 80, between 1.5-year-old to, I think, 7 was the oldest.
Yeah.
Like one. So it wasn't just big bucks. It wasn't just spike. It was, you know.
Yeah.
So you got, and which is, you'd want to do that for science to see if there's any difference in how older. So this, and there's so much more to the study, but talking about those groups that go, those bucks that go find a new home range, that smaller amount, let's say it's 15%, that we've all dealt with this. You had him on camera all summer. You're like, man, he is fine. This is going to be great. October, where did he go?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, we'll see him again during the rut. You don't even see him during the rut.
Yeah.
So there's this group of bucks who will just up and have another home range. They summer in a place and they go their winter home. And there's this one buck in the South Mississippi Delta area I'm pretty familiar with. And this buck would spend hunting season in the fall and the winter. He was in Mississippi.
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean, you see, because I got ping, 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 ping from all the radio stuff.
It goes off every 15 minutes. Yeah, tells them where they're at every 15 minutes.
Right. And he's doing all the normal buck stuff.
Yeah.
He's making his little circuits. Then the rut comes in, he makes big, you know, circuits looking for, but it's all kind of in that zone. And then for 3 years in a row, at a certain time in the spring, it was within days of when it had been the year before, that joker walks to the banks of the Mississippi River, gets in it, swims across to the Mississippi River, gets out on the other side and spends 3 months over in Louisiana. And he did 3 years in a row. And then he comes back.
3 months later, he comes back.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
And I mean, this to almost like within days of when they did it before, And you might say, well, they need certain things. Y'all spend any time there, it's the same bean fields on the east side of the river in South Mississippi Delta as they are beans and rice on the – I mean, it's ag on both sides of Mississippi there. Right. Whether you're over at Lake Providence, Louisiana, or you're at Rolling Fork, Mississippi, I mean, it's the same ag.
Yeah. Yeah. And it makes no sense they would do that.
There's something, you know, in their wiring that I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. I don't know how – but maybe it helps explain how you have that buck on camera forever, all summer, yeah. And then you're like, dude –
what happened? Somebody killed him. He got hit by a car.
Right.
You know, that's what you think.
Yeah. The other thing we talked about during the break is also in that interview, and we'll be quick about this because you can go back and listen to the whole thing.
Yeah, you need to go back and listen to it. I haven't listened to it either, Sean. Yeah, so from what you told me.
So, Mike, we have a podcast page. You can go to fmtalk1065.com.
Click the button. I got an excuse.
It's a good time to listen to podcasts when you're on the road. So, the moon chart thing, and this is a thing that I'm not going to pretend I live by this thing.
Yeah.
It made me, these are going to be the days I'm going to look at this. I really need to get out in the woods early today because I need to be out there at one from 1 to 4 versus 3 to 5:30. You know what I'm saying? I need to be there mid-morning or early morning, all those things because the moon charts, right? Grew up reading these things.
Yeah.
Their telemetry study. And Bronson, Dr. Strickland says, he said, I grew up using the same charts, thought the same thing. They saw no effect.
Zero effect.
So they overlaid,
when the moon comes whether it's full moon, moon, quarter moon, half moon, it made no difference in their activity.
Nope.
Isn't that amazing?
He said,
all of us was going by the moon.
100%.
Yeah.
They had, picture this, all the points on the map, right? The dots from where the GPS colors go off. And they tracked it. And then they said, okay, let's overlay what the moon times were during that period of time. Behavior didn't change. He said, here we are on like quarter rising apogee. He lays down till this point. He gets up and goes here. Okay, well, let's do it when it's the peak moon. He lays in the same bed, gets up and goes there. Yeah. He's like, it didn't. The old thing we also talked about during the break, it always been around cattle in my life growing up. It was always like, wow, those cows are on their feet. Deer moving.
We got to get in the woods quick.
Get in the woods, boys.
Yeah, man. The cows are up and feeding.
I don't know that
didn't make any difference at all.
So, in other words, but I think the benefit of it is, it's what I often say about the benefit of game cameras is it keeps me in the woods longer, knowing a certain deer's there.
Yeah.
And also, I think the moon charts, when I believed them until very recently, it got me to go, not just go to the woods certain time, but really focus because I felt like,
yeah, it's going to 3 and 5. It's going to happen. Yeah.
That's right. So, whatever keeps you in the woods. I mean, it's just like, you know, the more time you're in the woods, more chance you have to kill a deer. I tell a story about my late father. We were fly fishing out in Montana, and he's just whipping me.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty good fly caster. I'm a decent fly caster for an Alabama boy. Nothing fancy, but I'm casting and I'm throwing drives and picking pockets and throwing the fly in there, and Dad's catching 3 fish to my 1. And he's using a nymph with an indicator. And I said, Dad, what are you doing? He said, I'm keeping my fly in the water where the fish are, son, while you're just waving the thing around. He said, the more time the fly is in the water, better chance of catching a fish. I said, you got a point, Dad.
Yeah.
You got a good point. So more time in the woods.
You know, the other thing about the study, I mean, you know, we always thought that full moon, well, we want to go hunt in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd go hunt in the middle of the day.
Because we thought they did all their running around in the middle of the night. And so they would then rest, and then they would be back up for that.
Middle of the day. You know, and I've gone and seen them in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
But I never put 2 and 2 together if the rut was going on at the same time.
Right. So you, because if you believe, I'm with you. I mean, I'm like, I'm not preaching to anybody except myself here. You're so tuned in to this is when you need to be in the woods because the moon chart told you.
Yeah.
Then you see that deer. And you're like, of course, I saw that buck because of the moon chart. Instead of like Mike said, no, probably because he's up and cruising. It's during pre-rut or rut. Yeah, like, don't worry about that part. It's the moon chart.
One thing about the rut, you can see deer in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, they move. When they are really in the peak of rut, there is no telling when you're going to see that deer. They are just up and moving all the time.
Yep.
Unless they got a doe bedded down somewhere, and that's just where they're staying. Most of them are up and looking, and you'll see deer in the middle of the day a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, in unexpected places.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, why is he standing here? It's 1:30 in the afternoon because he's up and moving. And if he'd have been sitting there, I know I'm preaching to myself. I do sit all day. Yeah, it is a great study, and y'all can go back and looking at it, it's important. So if you look for MSU, so Mississippi State University, the only shout out I give the Cowbells, their biology program is fantastic.
Yeah.
So MSU Deer Lab. And then if you'll look at collar study, you'll see it. You link through, or we can put it up on the Facebook page. But it's something really cool to look at, and it reinforces some things that we thought about. The travel movement, how bucks move around food plots,
yeah,
is fascinating.
Yeah,
it reinforces what we thought. It reinforces what we thought.
So,
like, if you're going to kill a buck, you get back until the rut. You get back off the food plots, and it's just the way they tried to keep themselves in the vicinity of the most food plots without being in one. Like in the study, they'd have, like, let's say your property got 600 acres and you got three or four food plots up towards the north end, two south end or whatever. They made their loop cutting through between the sets of food plots instead of going around them. Not every time. That's the thing, too. It shows some days they just didn't do any of that.
Yeah.
But you can see the repeated lines. Like, you can see the tracks when you get to a place you catch a lot of snapper. You look at the tracks on there, how there's – sometimes you went in loop because the current was different, but there's a real dark bunch of lines right there where you're approaching the wreck. That's kind of what these show you. The bucks did do different things, but more often than not, they did, you know, certain travel patterns. It's something you got to look at. It's a good eye-opener out there. So some things are reinforced. Some things, like the moon chart, well, take what you thought you knew and – yeah.
Throw it out the window.
Throw it out the window out there.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. I mean, I know we talk about it on the show from time to time, but really, what we're learning in wildlife biology right now is something.
Yeah.
The fact that you can not just say, okay, I saw that buck bedded over there, and I saw him out in so and so's field that afternoon.
Yeah.
You could say, you know, and they were tagged or whatever. You can say, okay, well, they moved from here to here. That's all we knew before. Starting using radio telemetry and GPS, now we go, yeah, but in the meantime, he went here and here and here. He did this and this and went, you know, you get a full story of
When you ping every 15 minutes, I mean, that deer is pinging and letting them know exactly where he's at every 15 minutes. You know, you get a big pattern on that.
Yeah, and you see things like how they all don't do the same thing. But how some do the same thing. It also, I mean, you get in there, the idea that you found the buck's bed, this is where he beds every day.
Yeah.
You got him. That stuff kind of gets thrown out, too. Now, regions and areas that they bed in, absolutely, shows that there's certain. But the idea that, I mean, we're talking about a 50-acre block that they bed in. But I'm guilty of this growing up. Like, this right here, this thicket, this is where this buck beds most of the time.
Way around it. Make sure the wind's right before you go around it.
Chances are he could be a quarter mile away.
Yeah.
Like, so a lot of that stuff is very interesting in it. All right. Come back. I want to talk a little bit. Yeah. So we'll have maybe we'll run that show. I'll have a best of coming next weekend because I'm getting ready to get on the airplane and go see if my hiking here at sea level.
So where are you
level,
going?
Utah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that when you come back.
Go from 250 feet elevation here where I train up to about 9,000. Hopefully I'll make it back. We'll see.
I think you will.
We'll see. All right. Coming right back. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward for FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. By the way, too, we're just watching the video there during the news break. I want to say a big thank you. We're going to have him come on the show with us. My buddy Logan Copeland, he and his partner with Surgical Precision Shooting. Awesome. Military trained snipers.
Right.
Okay. But Logan can speak regular people language and coach you up. And he does this. He teaches. If you go look him up, Surgical Precision Shooting, you'll see him on Facebook or their website, local guys. But just next level shooting. And for this, you know, this is the first time I think I bought a new rifle. And let's say a non-modern sporting rifle,
right,
a hunting rifle, in a long time.
Yeah.
And so I got a new rifle for this. It's a a mountain rifle, so lighter, you know, carbon fiber barrel, all that. And
what caliber is it?
280 ACLI improved.
Yeah.
Okay.
See, so I'm not real familiar. I'm not familiar
with
that.
Yeah, and it's not a – you don't see it, you know, everywhere. It's not, you know – I mean, people – I looked at Win Mags. I looked at a couple different – 300 Win – you know, but this one was a caliber I liked.
Yeah.
And got the, you know, got a different one that, you know, those mountain rifles are just, they shave weight where they can.
Right.
Because everything goes on your back.
That's,
you know,
right. Going uphill most of the time.
Yes, somehow. It's always uphill somehow. But the, so, and I got a turret scope, the first turret scope I've ever had.
Yeah.
On top of that, I remember Logan asked me, so you got a rangefinder? I said, of course, I have a rangefinder, you know, use out west too, you know, but I've always just hunted with a regular scope. He said, well, you got to see this new one. So, he said, you got a turret scope, you need this rangefinder. And it's from, this one's from Vortex. And it does way, it's way smarter than I am.
Yeah.
You know, so there's stuff on it that I probably won't use for a couple years till I figure it all out. But it's really something because it takes the, when you range something, okay, it figures out, number one, where you are and where that is for elevation.
Right.
Right, for the shot. Distance, obviously.
Depending on what caliber you're shooting.
It's all in the app on my phone that talks
right
to it. I'm shooting 140 grain, you know, 280 ACLI improved. Here's the muzzle velocity. Here's all this goes into it, right? And it also senses humidity, rotation of the earth, Coriolis effect, all these things. It does that. The only thing you have to put in is wind speed.
Yeah.
And you can get, Kestrel makes something that does it, but a pretty good wind speed judge. And so, you know, you put that in, and then you plot it in, and it tells you what adjustments to make. You know, and so the shot we were just watching was 980 yards.
Right.
So that's
you
my
shooting.
I was shooting. That was my longest shot. And made the 980 yard shot. Of course, it was like 2.5 full revolutions of a turret for elevation. And then you can elevate the left. I mean, you can dial in the left and right, or you can, if you're looking through my scope, you can see minutes of angle and know that, okay, it's a 1 minute of angle hold right or hold left or whatever.
Right.
Make that adjustment there. It's something. And Logan, a great teacher, and they're doing classes, teaching folks here. We're going to get him to come in and talk more about it. Something. It really is. Like, you might say, well, I'm not even hunting out west, which you should. But do you hunt power lines?
Yeah. Yeah.
You hunt along road?
Yeah.
You ever seen a buck at 500 yards? You're like, yeah, I wish I could have shot him.
Yeah.
You can.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
they love, they go for the long range shooting.
There's a lot of folks that do.
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily, you know, that they're going to kill a big buck or something, but they like to shoot a doe at 1,000 yards or 1,200 yards.
Yeah, it's something.
You know?
And there's a lot that goes, you know, there's like you go, oh, well, you just get that scope and dial it in. Yeah, there's stuff you have to learn. That's why it's good to have Logan, like, he said, okay, you got the equipment, but the equipment's great.
You just got to know how to
use it. You got to train the person to use
it.
And that's what, you know, it's really good, his instruction. And, like, really kind of even changed my trigger pull, how I hold the rifle.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been shooting rifle since I was 8 years old.
Sure.
You got habits. This is how I do it.
Yeah.
And you learn a lot. You learn
so
a lot
you're talking about trigger pull. You're talking about the weight of the trigger or
how you pull the trigger.
How you put your finger on the trigger.
And I don't like this new trigger very much, which is a whole other conversation, but how you pull the trigger.
Okay.
I mean, how do you grab, if you had a rifle, how would you grab it with your right hand?
The trigger?
How you grab the rifle? Around the handhold, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then you hold it there and your finger goes on the trigger.
Right.
Well, but by nature of that muscle gripping it, you're going to torque that rifle some. And at 100 yards or 150 yards Alabama, it doesn't really
matter.
It
makes no difference.
Start doing these longer shots, that torque, same way, and it made sense to me talking with him, that when I'm teaching people to shoot a bow and all that, I'm like, have it to where the bow will fall out of your hands.
Yeah.
So you don't torque it, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I really have to work out, you know, I shoot a long bow. I mean, it's real critical there. Well, you do it with a rifle too. If you don't notice, he changed kind of the way I aligned how I hold the. I don't grip the rifle. I have a finger along the side, then the trigger, and there's a lot to it. And I really appreciate his instruction.
Trigger weight makes a big difference.
Big time. Yeah, and I had one that I thought was supposed to be. I'm not crazy about the trigger, but I've now figured out how to work with what I got right now.
Yeah,
because getting a new trigger, you know, wasn't in the cards.
So
got that rifle, but yeah, that it was cool, and we will have Logan come in and talk about it. Ready to go to Utah, heading out, mule deer hunt, drew a tag this year. My partner and I, they usually hunt out west together. He and I have been putting in, I think this one took us 5 points for this place. And there's different, there's general, I mean, and each state's different. I've talked to y'all over time, and we'll do a show come February about tags and all that stuff again, how to kind of get in that game.
Yeah. But you're not guaranteed every year to get a tag.
No, no.
Most of these western states are, it's hard. Now, some of them you can buy over the counter.
You can, but, yeah. But certain states, like elk in Colorado, okay?
Yeah.
You can buy over-the-counter tags to hunt elk in Colorado. It is at a tough time to hunt elk when they've been pressured. And this, but people are successful every year.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and we've talked about this on the show in the past. It is a formula out west because there's only so many critters. They go, okay, how many can we take out? Okay, we could take out 10% of the population this year without affecting it, you know, keep growing. Okay, well, what's our effective hunter rate? Well, it's, you know, if it's 100%, you can only have, let's say there's 100 elk in the unit, which is not, these numbers are not right. But
right.
For, there's 100 elk in the unit, and they said they can take 10 out and not affect the population. And the hunter success rate's 100%, then you can only have 10 tags.
That's right.
They realized that if the hunt, if the success rate's 10%, right, you can have 100 tags. You see what I'm saying? Like,
right.
And that's what they're, and that's what they're banking on. And there's different units managed different ways. Now, elk, which I try to draw in Colorado, but I'm trying to draw archery. So I have to draw that one because there's a lot higher percentage of success on that.
Yeah.
For our mule deer hunt in the area, you can do limited unit, limited entry unit for deer, which we're building points towards. I did a general, but it still took me five.
Yeah.
To get that.
In Utah.
In Utah. Now, yeah. I've talked about Colorado before. New Mexico, I mean, it's a straight lottery every year. You should put in for it no matter what because it just it's a lottery. Yeah. There's no points building. But like places like Colorado, my theory is, and people can prove me wrong, but I'm not going to be around long enough to draw one of these super tags that takes you 30 points to draw. I don't have 30, you know. So what I've done out there on the mule deer side, not on the elk side, I'm just still building points, is – try to draw the areas that I've hunted before. Because some units might be better numbers, but when you fly out or drive out somewhere like that, having experience on that ground is real important.
Difference.
And so
sure
I would say to somebody wanting to do something like Colorado-wise, and it varies in different states, Wyoming, Montana, but for Colorado, if you've always thought about going elk hunting, you might ought to go, I think the tag, it used to be $680, I think, for an out-of-stater over-the-counter elk tag.
That's what you get drawn.
No, I was saying for over-the-counter, you can buy an elk tag in Colorado, not at the prime season.
Okay.
But what I would argue to do is I'd say, hey, you know what? If you thought about, I've always wanted to do this. Okay. Go out, get an over-the-counter tag for elk. Okay. You, chances are you're not going to kill one, but you might. Right? If you look at the stats, all of us with a southern accent seem to be more successful around the camps than people from elsewhere. I'll just say that. That's just been what I've noticed. But in doing that, I would go hunt over-the-counter elk in an area that is a unit that you would try to draw for mule deer. Yeah. So now you can just go your first year, and you get to know the land, right? Because even though you're
smart,
and you know you, it might see some mule deer and all that, but you know, okay, when the snow hits, most of the game is pushed down to here. They follow this, you know, valley down. They go over here. Here's how I get down this road. Here's how I get from the campsite here. So when you get drawn for mule deer in the future, for example, you still got to find the deer you're hunting, that, but you know where you're going.
Right.
Right. Instead of going to a new unit every 4 or 5 years and you know nothing, find a unit that you can draw with 3 or 4 points or 2 points, something like that. Below 2 points might not be worth going, but, and also watch out. There's some units you're like, oh, that's an easy draw and they got great success. It's 90% private land. You got to find something, for me, public. You got to find something public. That's at least 50% public land.
Yeah.
But yeah, go out and do an over-the-counter elk hunt, learn the land, and then start putting in for mule deer tag.
That's a good idea.
Just, yeah, just a way to.
Yeah.
And instead of just sitting at home going, oh, I wish, well, you know, I mean, this hunt I'm about to leave on, who knows if we're going to kill deer or not. It's going to be hard.
Sure.
Now, I will say, Utah, because of some oil and gas exploration, has two tracks that go up to like, you know, roads, you can get up to like 9,000, 9,500 feet, 10,000. That's sure nice, because in Colorado areas we hunt everything above about 7,500. You're on your feet.
Yeah. You drive up to 9,000.
Yeah, yeah. Really? Believe me, Onyx and I have spent a lot of time together looking at the two tracks.
Well, it's a good thing you have there too. You got some buddies that you've met.
Yeah, some people that hunt that area
and hunt that area and live out there.
Yes.
So that's going to be a big advantage for you.
Yeah. So and you know, we get to know that, and I'd probably, you know, depending on how the hunting is, probably start putting in again to draw that same unit, because I'll now have known, you know, how to get around.
Right.
And I'll put in for elk there, which I have elk points, you know, because now I know that unit. There's elk in that unit as well. But yeah, there's but it takes a lot. It takes a lot of doing to hike around with everything on your back. So what I was getting at is, go do the OTC hunt, because a big part of this to me is the challenge of doing it, testing yourself.
Yeah.
You know, hunting out west.
You got to get there to start with.
That is correct.
Yeah, you got to go.
It ain't that easy.
That's right.
All right, coming right back. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have you all along. And Mike and I were talking during the break, too. We talked about the podcast with Bronson Strickland. But I'll tell you another one. With bow season here, man, our discussion with Scott Vernon from Bowhunter Pro Shop.
Really good show.
The hows and whys of archery in today's world. And we talk about what happened in the past and stuff, but everything that goes into having, you know, I kind of think about it too, with all the stuff I've had to learn with the long range shooting with the rifle.
Yeah.
Just the mechanics that, you know, the aim small, miss small kind of stuff, that also exists in archery. And Scott talks about what leads to the best outcome.
Yeah. That was a great show we did with Scott.
Yeah.
Great show.
And again, we had just.
We might play that again. I mean, yeah, really need to be playing it right now almost, because this, you know, it's archery season now.
Well, maybe we'll play it next week, because I won't be on top of a mountain. So
yeah, it'll be a good time.
Yeah, so maybe we'll do that. Hey, you know, we also talked about this for you in Kansas, for me out west. And I just threw out that just kind of off the top of my head, that over-the-counter elk thing, but that gets you going.
Yeah,
you might, because you can sit and say, "Listen, I did it for a long." When I turned 40, it's when I said, "Enough of this. One day I'm going to do it."
Yeah.
I said, I'm just gonna do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you have to do.
And I didn't have I don't have the money to go on the, you know, big guided place and stuff. We had to do it on a budget.
Yeah.
And but there's tons of land out there, and there's the resources now for research and stuff on the web is so incredible compared to when I was working at Quince a long time ago. I had a guy come in and start talking to me. He said, "You ought to go out west and hunt. You seem like a guy that would like it." I'm like, yeah, I would.
Yeah.
He said, "Well, you got to mail, you send a letter to the state, and then they send you a digest that has units, and there's number codes." And I'm like, what, you know?
Yeah.
Back then, now it's way easy.
Well, you understand it now because you've been.
But online, you can also, it explains what, you know, DMR05R2.
Back then, you didn't have internet to go to look that up.
So you can do that stuff. You figure it out. There's a lot of sources for information. But yeah, like you said, for Kansas, you know, you just went.
I've been wanting to go for a long time.
Long time.
You know, but I kept saying, well, I don't want to go by myself. I don't know anything about Kansas. Never been out there, you know. And then we had Jay Graddick on the show all the time, you know. And he goes, been going for 20 years. You know, and every year he'd say, "Man, you ought to go out there with me. You ought to go out there with me." And then after about the third or fourth year, I said, "I'm going." you know? So that's what I did.
It takes going, and it takes, like, time not hunting.
Yes.
That's kind of what I was saying, too, about burning units out west and trying to get a strategy where you have something that you have a chance to draw a few times, because you got to ride and learn.
Yes.
You know, all of us just want to – I get it. You only have so many days off of work. You got family responsibilities. You want to hunt back home. Oh, no, I want to go out there. But you got to go out there and learn it.
You do.
And not while you're hunting. I mean, if you can and hunt at the same time, it's great. But like the OTC thing, that's what I thought. But you got to spend time figuring it out.
You do have to. And, you know, the first year I went out there with Jay, I hunted with Jay a little bit. But I hunted public land, too. I didn't want to.
Right.
You know, let him take me every time. I mean, I didn't want to mess him up, so I went and hunted some public land, you know. And there's a lot of public land out there, and I ride around those public places all the time. And I see a car here and a car there. You know, it's just not over-hunted.
Right.
You know, your biggest battle is getting your tag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get your tag and get out there, you know, there's lots of public land. You don't have to be on private land. The only disadvantage to public land is when you take a stand in to hunt out of it, you're supposed to bring it back out that same day.
And yeah, and also, you know, like Kansas. So my experience with Kansas has been bird hunting.
Yeah.
I used to go out there, my buddy and I used to go out there hunting pheasants and quail. And and it's big now, but it was starting back then, the Weehaw, the walk-in hunting area. So
that's right.
Private landowners get a tax abatement or whatever, and they have, and so there's a map of that too. So you have the regular like management area or whatever they call it there, land, but you also have private parcels that are accessible as long as you have your license. But you know what? You still have to go scout.
That's
right. You have to figure out, you know, but that's fun.
I loved it.
It's an adventure. You know? It's worth doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, and like I said, too, part of it to me is the adventure. I mean, there's probably easier way for me to go hunt a mule deer than what I do. I mean, it's pretty tough, but it's the, I don't know, it's the excitement of doing something that's a little bit tough. I sit in enough shooting houses back at home, you know.
Yeah.
Doing something a little tougher.
Yeah.
It's fun. I mean, heck, why do you think I duck hunt?
I mean, I've been up to Kansas 3 times so far, you know, this year. For me, it's all been working. Putting stands up, putting feeders out, filling feeders, doing all, you know.
That's kind of fun.
It is. I enjoy all that, you know. I really do. But we're really getting ready for the rut. That's what, and even Dylan recognized that. He says, I know I'm not going to kill a deer while we're up here this week, but I know that we're getting everything ready for the rut, and I come back.
But he might kill a deer, but
yeah. But his chances are slim in October. It really is. But it's, anything could happen. But he understood that November was going to be his best chance to kill a deer, and we're getting everything ready, more stands out and in good places. So when he goes, you know, he'll have a lot better opportunity to kill a big deer.
Yeah, and maybe if you get an elk tag, eventually kill.
Well, you have to be a landowner, or a resident to get an elk tag in Kansas.
Well, you know what? Time to move.
Yeah,
looking at that bull, I'll be out in high mountains of Utah, and I don't know if I'll see a bull like the one you had there on your deer lease in Kansas.
Yeah, he was really good. I mean, it really was amazing to get that on our camera. But he, like I said, he came in for 10 minutes, and he was gone, and we hadn't seen him since. And I'm sure he was just coming through.
It was cool stuff.
And I don't know how they even hide out there, Sean. I mean, it's just wide open fields, cow pastures, corn fields, wheat fields, whatever, you know. And how they get in there and hide,
I don't know.
It's unbelievable.
It's cool stuff. And reminder too here, y'all, love to hear from you. Get lucky here. If you've already done that this week with bow season open, you kill a good one, drop us a picture at facebook.com/FMTalk1065Outdoors. I know this. I can give you this report from my place. And no, we haven't planted because we don't have rain.
No rain.
But it was like a conversation we had a while ago that maybe the drought stress made the acorns fall fast, but they're on them at my place.
Yeah.
The few oak trees I have are dropping and the deer are on them.
Yep.
Good luck to y'all. And we'll do it again whenever we all get back from assignment.